Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Sometimes it seems Congress has become the most toxic battlefield in the Republic. On this show, we hear about bridging the divide.
If we don't skillfully engage, we will never make progress. We will just go in our corners and we'll stay in the echo chamber.
That's conservationist Jimmy Fox. His viewpoint on civility is mirrored by libertarian Mike Prox.
The best way is to go talk to your neighbor. And it's amazing how well that works. Knock on the door, smile, start up a conversation.
And Chris Lott examines liberty and freedom.
I was surprised to realize that despite the ascendancy of the word freedom, it doesn't appear even once in the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution.
I hope you'll stick around. Like many of you, I've been alarmed by the intense and bitter tone of our current social and political discourse. Pundits point to various contributing factors, everything from economic disparity to social media. In this episode, I chat with two Fairbanks residents with differing perspectives, but they share a common belief that respectfully and intentionally talking with others is key to achieving greater public civility. I'll start with conservationist Jimmy Fox, who serves on the Fairbanks Borough Sustainability Commission.
You did a TED Talk several years back, and really looking at what the greatest question confronting humanity was. And that comes from Aldous Leopold. And what did he, and what do you think, is the most important question we face today?
Leopold said, you know, that basically the oldest task in human history is living on a piece of land without spoiling it. And boy, do those words ring true today. And I think what we're trying to do here in the borough with the Sustainability Commission is just move the needle in that direction. Can we try to find a way to live more sustainably here in the far north, where we are challenged with the Arctic environment? But I have learned, I think as Leopold did over his conservation career, that many of our greatest conservation challenges really lie within ourselves. It's not so much the ecology, you know, understanding how the landscape works. It's the greatest difficulties are really how can we change the way we interact with our home in a way that's more sustainable. And solving that problem is much more difficult than understanding air quality or water pollution. How do you remove or reduce pollution? How do you live more sustainably? And that's a really, really difficult adaptive challenge. And it's not a technical problem. It's something that requires adaptation from us. And how do we get us to change?
Now, you're a biologist by training and education. Where did your love of biology and the wilderness come from?
Well, I had no choice. I think I grew up in a rural area of southeast Missouri, and my parents left rural southeast Missouri to find work in St. Louis. And by the time I was 2 years of age, my parents did not want to raise me in St. Louis. And so they took pay cuts and did the best they could to stay employed back where they grew up in southeast Missouri. And my first memories of childhood are really outdoor experiences. And we lived in a home on the end of a dirt road in the Ozarks, in the woods, in the forest. And so this was in the late 70s. I was outside except when it was time to eat or time to go to bed. So, I just was surrounded with nature. And, of course, my parents, my grandparents, they were, you know, growing vegetables in the garden. We were fishing. We were hunting. In the summers, I fished with my grandfather, who was retired at that time. He fished 5 days a week. just like work. You know, every day at 7 o'clock, he was driving down his driveway with the boat in tow, and so we fished 5 days a week, every day in the summer. So I was just lived outside and in nature, surrounded by nature, and it just seemed that this work in conservation might be something that I would enjoy. I didn't really understand what the training and the education would require of me and whether or not I would be well adapted to that, but I knew that I wanted to work with wildlife and nature and the outdoors, and so that's the path I took. But it started walking deer paths in the Ozark woodlands and spending hours and hours in a boat fishing, listening to birds, hunting ducks. And ironically, I spend very little time outdoors in nature today as a professional conservationist, but what motivated me to do what I do today was definitely came from my childhood.
Was there somebody or an idea, a writer, a teacher that ignited your imagination and passion as you went forward?
Yeah, definitely. Growing up in a rural area, you know, I didn't have too many opportunities to really get to know professional conservationists. However, the local game warden for the state agency lived in my area. And when I was 16, I met him, and he very much wanted to help aspiring young conservationists, and he took me under his wing, answered all my dumb questions, allowed me to go for rides with him to see his work and understand what it is this conservation profession is all about. Mick Plunkett is his name. He's still back there in Missouri. And Mick was greatly influenced by the writing of Aldo Leopold, as many conservation professionals have been. And I obtained my first copy of the San Kelly Almanac when I was 16 and just really dug into the book. So it was having a mentor, an adult mentor in the profession, and then also having those inspiring words and passages from San Kelly Almanac.
I know among the projects that you're engaged in is a better understanding about how we burn wood and about how we keep our air clean and healthy for all of us. When did you see there was nature on one side and human activity, but they were linked in some way?
I was drawn to the issue partly out of concern for my children's health. They were attending a charter school in one of the worst areas of the borough for poor air quality or air pollution. And partly I was drawn to it out of curiosity because all I had known for home heating was with wood. And today my father and my brother back in rural Missouri use outdoor hydronic heaters to heat the home, to heat their water. So it was a really interesting issue for me. In a way, it challenged my values, my preconceived notions about is wood smoke harmful or not. You know, it smells great. It reminds you of campfires and family. But yet here you're confronted with science and how does smoke interact with our bodies and what produces more smoke? What are the devices we use that produces the most smoke? And soon, you know, I realized that these tools don't have an opinion about what comes out of the stack. It's really just what we put into it. And hydronic heaters are wonderful inventions, but they have a time and a place. And unfortunately, those devices put out a lot of smoke. And when you put a device like that in a urban area, you're going to subject your neighbors to a lot of smoke. And so here I had my father and my brother that these devices they have, these outdoor hydronic heaters, are wonderful devices for them. And the smoke that comes from their stacks is not an issue because it wafts down into the valleys of the woods and the rivers and not into their next-door neighbors' homes. That's not the case in Fairbanks. That was an interesting juxtaposition of where the science and the values were coming into play here. But the air quality issue in Fairbanks is definitely an issue where science and then human values and our resistance not to change, but our resistance to loss comes right into play, and it's obvious for everyone that's involved to see.
This is Northern Soundings, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jimmy Fox, a local conservationist and a member of the Fairbanks North Star Borough's Sustainability Commission. After this short break, adaptive leadership. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. I'm speaking with Jimmy Fox, conservationist and a member of the Fairbanks Borough Sustainability Commission. Let's get back to the conversation.
Certainly the question of hydronic heating and air quality here in Fairbanks is polarized. You did this TED Talk a number of years ago, and you were hopeful. You thought that there were ways of overcoming this polarization. What were the key points that you wanted to convey?
Several years ago, I was exposed to some learning that's been delivered for a number of years at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And the title is, How Do We Lead People Through Really Messy Issues? And this idea of adaptive leadership. And it really resonated with me because it makes it clear that people don't resist change, they resist loss. And that is the reason that we have kind of these intractable, messy problems. When people's values come into play in an issue, suddenly it's not just a technical problem, it's an adaptive challenge. In this training, the idea of a technical problem is a flat tire or a broken arm. We have standard operating procedures, we have authority figures, we just need some time and money and we can make the problem go away. An adaptive challenge, on the other hand, there's technical elements to it, but some people may be resistant to the solution. The expectation is not to come up with an easy, quick fix. The right attitude is just to try to make progress, because this adaptation is going to be required for people to give up something that matters to them. That's hard and can be slow work. And that training just really changed my life. It helped me understand what Otto Leopold was talking about so long ago. He didn't have the benefit of social science research that we do today, but he was putting into language what this adaptive leadership model really is getting at. He talked about a land ethic and that conservation, all of the conservation challenges in the 1920s and 30s were not going to be solved with more government money. It was really going to be solved when people saw that there was a problem and they wanted to fix it. And that's really today what we talk about when we talk about adaptive leadership. So in that training, it was like a light bulb came on for me, and I thought, wow, now I understand this air pollution issue. And I had this training in adaptive leadership at the same time that I was learning about the air quality problem in Fairbanks. So it really helped me see, okay, we're not going to solve this air quality issue overnight. Burning wood is something that humans have been doing for a long time. There are deeply held values that come with burning wood. There's economics involved. There's also human health issues involved. It's not a technical problem. I mean, it is a technical problem, but because of the human values, that makes it an adaptive challenge. If we were under a dictator, and the dictator said no more wood burning during air quality alerts, then there wouldn't be wood burning, and then the air quality would improve. But we don't live in that kind of a world, so we're forced with trying to work with each other to make progress, and it's going to be slow.
So really, we're very inclined, I think, to see the problem as the other.
Oh, yeah.
But your recommendation is to manage ourselves.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Oh, absolutely. That is the number one barrier to making progress on adaptive challenges. We are wired to point fingers at everyone else but ourselves. And we are really reluctant to own our piece of the mess. We often think that, you know, people just had the facts. You know, if they just had more information, if they just were educated, then the problem would go away. That's ill-informed. And so that thinking actually holds us back. So we have to manage our own expectations on how quickly we can solve things. We have to recognize that we have our own biases. We get triggered. We say things that hurt other people's feelings. We say things that will set relationships backwards. And it's really hard to resist those innate feelings that we have, that, you know, we've been wired over time to fight, flight, freeze, and we get triggered very quickly. And, you know,
don't you think it's also kind of in this age of internet and emails and stuff, it's very easy to demonize somebody you can't see.
Yeah.
And one of your recommendations was to imagine that person in the room with you.
Yeah.
And I find all my anger dissipates when I'm confronted with a real flesh and blood human being.
Yeah, that is so true. If you can just imagine trying to have a one-on-one conversation with somebody that you disagree with, I think that would hopefully change the tenor and tone of what we're seeing today and in these really intractable issues that we're having, whether it's climate change, air quality here in the borough, gun control, or whatever it might be. There's all sorts. And so it's really important, first of all, to ask yourself, is this a technical problem or an adaptive challenge? And then if it's an adaptive challenge, then you know right away, okay, I'm going to need to manage myself. You know, what are my vulnerabilities? Where do I get triggered? What are my default views? How do other people see me? When I say something, do other people, what are they hearing? Are they actually envisioning me putting them down? Does it sound like I'm shouting? We can all probably remember conversations we've had where someone accused us of being angry when we didn't think we were being angry. You know, so how we come across to others. So it's really important in these messy problems to first and foremost try to manage yourself, try to be curious. And I think the number one word for me is just humility. Just recognize that you own a piece of the mess. No one has a monopoly on the best ideas. Be curious. You're going to learn something as you move through this challenge with other people.
And you talk about skillfully engaging with others. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, it's really, you think about, again, like how am I coming into this conversation? How am I coming into this problem? And I'm going to have to engage others if I'm going to make progress, because adaptive challenges involve other people, not just people that agree with you. I mean, it's going to involve people that have differing opinions. And if we don't skillfully engage, we will never make progress. We will just go in our corners and we'll stay in the echo chamber. We'll get the dopamine fix when people agree with us, when we, you know, parrot talking points that we have inside of our tribes. And so getting comfortable with leaning in and engaging other people that we disagree with. And I think that really what I've learned, you know, what I've been taught, what I've experienced, I think of, we want to appeal to people's emotions. So find something that person cares about that's related to the issue. If it's air quality, you maybe have children or grandchildren that are going to school that is subjected to poor air quality, right? So that's something that's an emotion for someone, and that's a value. So find that connection to the issue or that person that you're trying to engage with. I think that's a good place to start. You want to show respect. If you don't show respect, it's obvious. I mean, just your conversations are going to go nowhere. unless the person just really, really tolerant and really wants to continue to have the conversation.
Like Gandhi or somebody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Keep being.
Yeah.
And then I think really importantly is to show the rewards of what that new solution might look like. What would be the rewards of cleaning up the air? What would be the rewards of reducing our fossil fuel emissions? What would be the rewards of weatherizing our homes? So rather than just focus on the loss that would come with that adaptation, think about the gains. And that's important because science has shown that we're wired to kind of focus on the loss. When we're presented with some recommendation, we pretty quickly go right to, you know, what am I going to lose in this? I mean, we sniff that out really quickly rather than, you know, okay, so I might have to give this up, but I might also gain some things. You know, I mean, you can think of that analogy and, you know, for the South and slavery, you know, the abolishment of slavery, you know, I think there was so much focus on the loss and not necessarily thinking about, well, what might we gain in the South in this new paradigm? But it's really hard to do that. But it's really important, I think, to appeal to rewards or show the rewards. Try to help people understand that it's not all bad, right? There's going to be some good here for you personally or your family, your child, your student, whatever it might be.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking this segment to Jimmy Fox, who serves on the Fairbanks Borough's Sustainability Commission. When we return from the break, moving beyond discouragement. You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This segment, I'm talking with conservationist and Fairbanks Borough Sustainability Commissioner Jimmy Fox. Let's get back to the discussion.
I think it's so easy for us to get gloomy. At least I'm speaking for myself. I get very discouraged sometimes when I see that air quality now in the United States is in retrograde in the last year, and I see attacks on the science behind climate change. But what I was so interested in hearing, and I think this goes back to managing ourselves, was this idea that it isn't some big technological fix, but it's really within our grasp to just kind of be a little more self-conscious and considerate.
Yeah, no, that's right. I really believe that we want to think of all of these problems as technical problems, and we want the authority figure to just make the problem go away, and we can go on about our lives, and we've got to come to terms with the authority figures can't solve this, and it's going to have to come from us. And the bright side of that is that we understand so much now about the way our brains work. We're learning how to prime ourselves to think about the gains. It's less intuitive work now than it was in Otto Leopold's time. We now know there's this whole school of what's called behavioral economics. And there's been a couple recent Nobel Peace Prize winners in economics that have written about this idea that using what we know about the brain, we can actually craft a different kind of intervention rather than kind of the top-down command and control authority figure solution. There are ways that we can actually nudge ourselves to adopt new behaviors. And this idea that you can design buildings in a way to reduce energy use. you can change the way you message concerns in a way that speaks to people's desire to be competitive, to want to keep up with their neighbors. So it's designing totally different interventions than what we've been doing over the past several decades. So I think it's very, very promising. Yes, it is tough sometimes to see what's going on, to see the science, to see the facts, and to see that we're not making the progress like we think we ought to be at the pace that we ought to be. But at the same time, at least we have these emerging tools that are coming out every day. There's new science that's coming out about the way the brains work and what motivates us to do new things. And I think it's fantastic, because waiting for the authority figures, for the government to solve things, clearly is not working. So we need to own our piece of the mess, and we need to exhibit leadership. And that's the key ingredient in this idea of adaptive leadership, is that we are capable of exhibiting leadership. Anyone, anytime, any place can exhibit leadership. It can be risky. You might upset members of your own tribe as you open up and listen to, air quotes, the opponent, right? That can be challenging. So it's just really important for people to understand that we can't just keep looking to elected officials to solve these problems that we created, that we are all owners of the mess, and government and elected officials aren't going to solve them. It's going to require us taking risk, having the courage to do that, and having the patience, the ability to manage ourselves and stay in there even though we get frustrated and it's slow and it doesn't feel good. I mean, we now know that we respond to words, and we can get chemical releases that'll make us feel good or make us angry or cause us stress. So there are biological responses going on when we're having these tough conversations, and it doesn't feel good, but we need to stay in there. But we also need to take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. You can't just
subject. I was thinking conservation of self too.
Yeah, I mean, you got to take care of yourself. So that's really important to, if you're in this work, it's really important to have a daily refuge, a place where you can go and you can sort through in your own mind, have a conversation with yourself. You know, what happened today? You know, how did I respond? You know, how might I respond tomorrow? And exercise, eating right, you know, just taking care of yourself, just the common sense things that this is really hard work and you got to be at the top of your game. Hmm.
So, Jimmy, if folks want to find out more about adaptive leadership or people who are examining this approach, where can they go?
Yeah, I'll recommend a couple reads. There's a lot more information that I could recommend, but I'll keep it brief. So the first older classic, Getting to Yes, by Roger Fisher and William Urey. And then a more recent work written by one of my mentors, Marty Linsky and Ronald Heifetz, and that's Leadership on the Line. Leadership on the Line and Getting to Yes.
Well, Jimmy Fox, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Robert. I really enjoyed it.
Links to the Fairbanks North Star Borough's Sustainability Commission and the books Jimmy Fox suggested are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return, former Borough Assembly member Mike Prox discusses air quality from a libertarian point of view. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. Longtime Fairbanksans will know Mike Prox's name. Mike served on the Fairbanks Borough Assembly, and since then, he remained civically engaged, perhaps most importantly, on the issue of air quality. As a libertarian, Mike is a strong advocate for self-responsibility and rights. But personal freedoms, he says, must not infringe on the rights of others. Like Jimmy Fox, both men believe respectful conversation is key to solving political and social disagreements. I began our conversation by asking what Fairbanks was like when his family arrived.
We moved to Alaska in 1969, got to the corner of 2nd and Cushman at 11:30 on June 21st, 1969.
Well, what were your impressions coming up? How old were you?
I was 13.
And what was the trip like for you, Mike?
Oh, it was great. We took, I think it was 3 weeks to drive up here from Minnesota, and I think we stopped at every stream between Minnesota and Fairbanks to fish.
What attracted your family to Alaska?
There was, what was the name of the movie? This Is My Alaska. And it was a story of hunting adventures in Alaska in the late 50s, early 60s. And they apparently were running around the country showing this movie, and it showed at a theater in the town next to us. And Dad went to see that film, and he thought that was just great.
Now, so it sounds like you guys were into outdoor activities, even in Minnesota.
Yeah, Dad liked hunting and being in the outdoors, and we lived in the rural part of Minnesota. So,
now, how many in your family, Mike?
Six. Four kids and two parents.
And where are you in the pecking order for kids?
I'm the second oldest.
Second oldest. Mm-hmm. Were all your siblings outdoors folks and enjoyed getting out there and camping and hunting and fishing?
Yeah, we all had a good time and then, enjoyed it, and that was a big part of growing up.
Now, your dad started a restaurant when he got here. Was he always entrepreneurial that way?
Yes, he was. We had a bakery and pizza parlor, I guess, in Minnesota. And then we moved up here, and he went to work in the camps. He was out at Chitka first, working for Universal Services. The Kanakin Project, the atomic bomb testing out on Chitka. And then he worked on some of the road construction camps, opening up the camp at Galbraith Lake and 5 Mile, and then Livengood, I think, was his last station there. And then he decided he didn't like to be away from the family so much, so he started the restaurant in 1971, I believe it was, when we started it.
So what was it like for a 13-year-old to come to Fairbanks?
Oh, it was great. There was some big street party. I don't know just exactly what it was, but we came from a fairly small town in Minnesota. And as I say, we got to the corner of 2nd and Cushman at 11:30, and there's the 2nd Avenue was just full of people celebrating the midnight sun, I guess it was, but we just had a great time. We spent the summer out by North Pole next to the Badger Slough and got to do all the adventures that you do when you're next to Badger Slough, and then we lived quite a ways, well, not quite a ways, like 3/4 of a mile off of Persinger Drive on Cloud Road, and that was, we were kind of by ourselves. You could just have all kinds of adventures just right there. And it was fun.
I'm sure. Yeah. Growing up would be fun. What were the schools like when you were growing up?
Schools were interesting. Of course, the construction was going on, and I graduated from Lathrop in 74. I want to say there was almost 2,000 students when I was at Lathrop. They went to double shifting
the
next
year. Double shifting, right, that's right.
But it was a good opportunity, I think, in many ways. It was easy to get lost and fall through the cracks, but because there were so many students there, there were a lot of opportunities for a variety of classes and whatnot. So you could pretty well do what you wanted to do if you wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. And so it worked pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you got done with high school, did you go into the family business?
I did for about a year, and then I went up to the university and spent three semesters up there studying economics and figured out I was going to go broke if I didn't get a job. So that was the end of my college career.
Well, that's an economic lesson
yes,
right there.
It was
there.
Good. It was a good lesson.
But why economics? Were you drawn to that?
I was. I really enjoyed that. It was an objective look at the way people relate to one another and then how that all ratchets up and all of a sudden you've got an economy. Mm. And it was later, I learned, fit quite a bit with Austrian free market economics. It was just good, just objective analysis of what people do. And
I don't know what Austrian free market economy is, but really one of the most appealing, I think, economics is that idea of Adam Smith's, you know, the invisible hand.
Invisible hand, yeah.
And it seems so intuitive and explains so much.
Yes. And it was written based on what he observed. I read Wealth of Nations. I think I might even have been in high school, but it was right around 74. And it was fascinating. And then I read it again just a few years ago and got a lot more out of it the second time, a lot more life experience.
Sure.
And it wasn't written promoting free market economics or any political system or anything like that. It was just his observation of how wealth is created and really how nations can succeed if they let people go do their own thing rather than try and control it. And he had his observation. It was amazing. For written in 1775 or 6, I can't remember, how much he knew about the world and how things worked in the Orient and the Mideast and whatnot. And he just observed that to the extent that you let people do their own thing, they're going to produce things. And to the extent you don't, you get into wars and government becomes more expensive and the nation doesn't prosper. But it was just a really good look.
Yeah,
at
so I read sections of it and really so impressed, about how persuasive he is mm-hmm. and clear.
Clear.
But that's an interesting thing. So I could see why you'd want to go into economics. But earning a paycheck also came into play. After those three semesters, what did you decide to do to get that paycheck?
Well, let's see. First, I went to work at the Black Angus restaurant down on the first floor of the Polaris building. That was kind of funny. I when I worked for my parents, I was a fry cook, basically, and worked in the bakery. And I thought I could get a job as a cook somewhere and wanted to kind of, I enjoyed that, the commercial cooking, and looked around for several weeks and didn't work. And finally went bussing tables at the Black Angus, but it was a good experience. And then I went to work for Bill Moore, Moore's Appliance, an appliance repair business until 77. I went to work for Alyeska and worked in Valdez for 3 years doing maintenance on their, mostly their power plant and ballast water plant down there, so heavy stationary equipment. And then I was able to transfer up to the pump station as I worked at pump station 6, maintenance and then operations on the pipeline equipment.
Did you always want to come back to Fairbanks? Is that always home?
Yes. Work in Valdez was really interesting, but at the time there was a lot of hostility between the residents of Valdez and these pipeliners that come in. Mm-hmm. In Alaska, until you've been here for 50 years, you're a newcomer.
That's right. So I know you've been on the borough assembly and you've been involved in local politics. Where did that passion come from, Mike?
I think probably the most influential person would have been Dick Randolph.
Hmm.
He was a regular at the restaurant, and then I suppose it was him introduced me to the Libertarian Party, and he ran for the state legislature, I think. This would have been 76, I believe. And it was just interesting. It was the free market principles applied to the whole society.
Help me, because I don't know much about the Libertarian Party. So for a guy like me, how would you explain the Libertarian Party? What is, are its planks or its important issues?
I suppose the bottom line is minimize violence down to a very low level, that you are free to do what you want, and I'm free to do what I want, and we have to recognize each other's right to do that. And the most self-governing and the least coercive governing is sort of the libertarian
philosophy. So internal motivations and ideas rather than being applied from external authorities or government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm talking with Mike Prox, former borough assembly member. When we return from the break, the organic nature of political engagement. Welcome back to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This segment, I'm talking with libertarian and former Fairbanks Borough Assembly member Mike Prox. Let's get back to our discussion.
So the idea there, and you can see how that invisible hand kind of blossoms into this political realm, the idea is if everybody conducts their business or their life in along these principles, sort of an evolutionary process emerges that will really maximize the greatest good for the greatest number.
Yeah, exactly. And as opposed to driving an outcome from a central authority, the organization naturally emerges from human interaction, that we get together to meet each other's needs, to serve each other, as opposed to get together to control somebody else to have them meet our needs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just essential, I think, for us to do that, to maintain a society.
Now, of course, our political landscape, the libertarians are just one element in it, and it's really a two-party system that dominates the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, how is that working? Because it seems to me that dialogue is getting more and more separated and polarized.
It is. And my perspective, to be honest, from starting from a libertarian background, we really have a single party system, and there's two groups competing for control of the central system. The political party labels are kind of the Democrats versus the Republicans. Now they're trying to say the liberals versus the conservatives or the progressives, or the names, the labels change.
Yeah.
But the names really don't mean what they used to mean. The word Democrat, one of the demoskratia or something, Latin term, rule by the people. The Republicans, the rule of law, etc. And that isn't really what's happening. They're just whichever group gets into power, they're more interested in controlling someone else. And mm-hmm. they're not, it's very difficult mm-hmm. to let somebody else do their thing that you might not condone.
So would it be fair to say that from a libertarian perspective, both Republican and Democratic parties aren't going to get you where a libertarian wants to go?
No, right. They won't. And it's interesting when you talk to the rank and file and you get away from the immediate issue, most people want liberty. They're willing to get along with people, and if I don't want to go to your bar or go to your hair salon or whatever, I make the choice to not do that. And if you think you need more people to relate with, you have to do something to make them want to associate with you. And by and large, that is what everybody wants. And it's, but it's difficult when you talk about it in the abstract, that's what people want. But when you talk about any specific thing, especially something that we're doing now, it's very hard to give up that control and that security of things being the way they are.
So a local issue that I know both of us are aware of is air quality, mm-hmm. and how to address air quality.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in this instance, of course, somebody may have a boiler, a hydronic heater, and it's kicking up a lot of fumes mm-hmm. that may harm somebody downwind or
right.
in the area. So from a libertarian perspective, that's somebody encroaching on somebody else's freedom?
It is, to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy, I think, is really appropriate for this, because you have a right to heat your house, no question about it, and you have a right to breathe air. Well, if you have, the way I look at it, then you have a right to own a dog, but you can't let your dog run on your neighbor's property. Well, the same way that you have a right to heat your home however you want to, really, but if whatever you're putting out infringes on somebody else's right, well, you should do something about that. You should govern yourself to do something about that and not wait for somebody else to tell you.
So in a situation like that, if you do have an individual who says, sorry, it smokes, too bad, so sad.
Yep.
What remedies this conflict? What would be a good way to resolve that?
The best way is to go talk to your neighbor. And it's amazing how well that works. You kind of got to get over the apprehensiveness of the apprehension of doing that.
You're kind of fearful, aren't you?
You're fearful.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But knock on the door, smile, start up a conversation. And I did that. We start out, that's what's wrong with air quality. It started out of being a big confrontation of a group that wanted clean air. You can agree or disagree about the health, but they wanted health. They have a right to breathe. I get it. And others that have a desire to maintain their home, you know, they save money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the two come together when you look at it and you go out and talk to people. They might be, big one was, still is, that people cut green wood and just for whatever reason haven't gotten on top of it. And just point out that, you know, if you wouldn't burn dry wood, you would save about 30% of the cost in either your effort or your out-of-pocket expense for heating your home. Well, they're kind of interested in that.
Saving money.
Saving money, yes. And the air gets cleaner. Well, we'll put up with cleaner air, too. So
yeah, if we have to.
Yeah, you can strike up a conversation, yeah.
Yeah.
And appreciate that somebody has a desire for this or that and the other, and just acknowledge that. And you get past the confrontation and just try and work together with people and find a solution that helps everybody.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happens, though, again, let's say that person just happens to be a jerk, let's say.
Yeah. My approach is, well, okay, fine. We talk, give them time. And it doesn't always work. There are people who are just completely self-centered. There is a certain number of those folks. But really, there's something.
You think by and large most people would be reasonable?
By and large, most people are reasonable. They're doing the best they know how. And not everybody knows the best way to do things. Well, there is no best way. There's a continual improvement on that. And you got to get people focusing on that and kind of taking responsibility for living with their neighbors. In the time that we've been up here in Alaska now, going on well over 50 years, when we first got up here, we were kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And we could do a lot of things that, well, certainly today, people would be critical of us doing those. And it didn't matter. We didn't run into somebody. But now you run into people a lot more than you used to. And you have to put up with that. You have to be considerate of other people, and you kind of have to grow that way to a degree. And that's part of life.
Mm-hmm. So when you served on the assembly, that didn't end your involvement. What do you look forward to in trying to move our local community, our state, and even our country forward?
Well, I guess.
Can you do it by next week?
Yeah, right. It does seem to be a calling. I do feel called to, if you will, be a missionary for that, to remind people that that was the original purpose of our country, which really set our country apart from the get-go in 1776. They decided, no, we didn't want central control. And when you study the history, people made a point of governing themselves. Not everybody, nothing is ever perfect, but they made a point of governing themselves. And they went through this revolution and got the British out, and then after that period found out that, well, we do need to establish a few rules here. But if you study the time period of the time that 1789, you would take the when they were talking about the Constitution, they got together and they still wanted the idea of liberty and individual responsibility and minimal, what's the least we can do that we have to do to govern ourselves. And that's huge, the expansion of the country, and that became a real idea for the whole rest of the world, that everybody wants that liberty.
Well, of course, looking at historically, people like Native Americans that kind of got run over on that Western expansion and whatnot. Yeah. But I really just kind of want to get a picture of you, and because we'll be talking about particular things from a libertarian perspective. But I see you have the Alaska Constitution with you. It looks pretty well thumbed, too, Mike.
I do go through that every once in a while.
These constitutions are really intended to set the groundwork, as it were, right?
Yeah. They are. The U.S. Constitution starts out with "We the People," and the Alaska Constitution, "We the People of Alaska." It is an agreement that we make between each other. And yes, it's an implied agreement. I didn't sign a piece of paper when we crossed the border to Alaska. And I was born into the United States. But it's an implicit agreement that we have with each other. And we need to honor that agreement. Mm-hmm. And it's all based on rights.
Where do you see playing out for, the 2020 election? What role can the Libertarian Party and Mike play going forward?
Well, I think we need to try and remind people of these core values, these core principles, and do you really honor what you say you want when it comes down to, I don't see the immediate benefit to me? Are you still willing to honor that agreement? That's what we need to get back to focusing on that.
I'm talking right now with Mike Prox. He's a former assembly member here at the Fairbanks North Star Borough, also a libertarian and conscious citizen, I'd say. Mike, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
I hope to have both Jimmy Fox and Mike Prox back, as well as other local citizens, on future episodes. When we return from the break, the roots of the word liberty. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. Chris Lott felt free this week to research the origins of the term liberty for this week's segment of Cachexia Clippings.
Like most beneficiaries and survivors of the U.S. educational system of the late 70s and 80s, I was taught early about the Declaration of Independence and drilled a little selectively, I now realize, in the basic tenets of the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson's summation of the core principles of the Declaration retain an admirable concision and elegance: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In my mind, each part of this founding formula becomes more complex as I grow older and arguably slightly wiser. I basically understand what life is, and I understand happiness to ultimately lie in the realm of the unabashedly subjective, but I'm still not sure what liberty really means. Nor, it seems, was Jefferson, as evidenced by the presence of legalized slavery in his own home and his nascent country. The word liberty, the state or condition of being free, comes to English from the Latin libertas, freedom, whose root, liber, free, gives us the familiar and equally complicated word liberal. Libertas became liberty in French, familiar in France's national motto, liberty, egality, fraternity, and is first unambiguously documented in English in the Tyndale Bible of 1526, where we find the words, "He who so looketh in the perfect law of liberty and continueth there shall be happy in his deeds." Initially applied only to individuals, the word liberty quickly moved from the me to the we, becoming a common term for describing groups of people who were free from the rules and whims of despots or autocrats. And so the origin of libertarian is clear. Take a focus on liberty and add the all-purpose Arian with an I suffix, and you have a political philosophy with liberty and freedom at its core, residing at one end of a spectrum whose opposite is populated by necessitarians, the ultimate hard determinists, to whom free will and thus freedom isn't even a thing. Most discussions and definitions of liberty use freedom as an interchangeable synonym. Starting from a peak around 1800, the use of liberty slowly fell relative to freedom, until the early 1900s, when freedom started pulling away and has maintained a sizable advantage ever since. My guess is this reversal of fortune was largely a function of the World Wars, where freedom was featured in the mottos, slogans, and popular rhetoric of that chaotic time. I was surprised to realize that despite the ascendancy of the word freedom, it doesn't appear even once in the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. And there's a possible dynamic behind the rise of the word freedom that subtly influences our vocabulary still. Unlike the Norman, through French, word liberty, freedom's roots come from the Saxon, through German, and broadly speaking, and most often subconsciously, because of the historical circumstances of the Norman invasions of England, words of Saxon origin have been preferred by common people, while words of Norman origin have been preferred by the ruling classes. This Saxon-Norman interplay also lies behind culinary synonyms for living versus cooked animals, such as sheep and mutton, swine and pork, and so on. The commoners who raised and butchered the animals were Saxons, while the new ruling class who ate the prepared meat were Normans. To this day, more than 950 years after the Norman invasions of England began, Britishers with Norman surnames, Campions, Devereux, Mandevilles, and the like, have on average more accumulated wealth and longer life expectancy than those with Anglo-Saxon last names. But while these origins might quietly influence our choice between freedom and liberty, is there more to it? Is there a meaningful difference? The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy says no, that some attempts have been made to distinguish the two, but generally speaking have not caught on. But I wonder, pondering my own use of the words and an informal survey of friends, I find a distinction. Freedom is perceived as an internal construct, liberty an external one. I can be deprived of my liberty by others, but no one can ultimately take away my freedom. As Virginia Woolf puts it in A Room of One's Own, "Lock up your libraries if you like, but there is no gate, no lock, no bolt that you can set upon the freedom of my mind." Or as Viktor Frankl put it in his indispensable memoir, Man's Search for Meaning, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." For more on liberty, including the sour liberty cabbage, and links to an even tartar ongoing debate about whether libertarians are in effect the new Marxists, fire up your browser and head on over to cotexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this edition of Northern Soundings. I hope you'll join me next time when we air a special New Year's Eve program featuring a conversation my former colleague Susan McGinnis recorded with the late Richard K. Nelson, who passed away earlier this year. I hope you'll join us for that. Thanks for listening.